aboard a mule and rode up Salacy to spy out Napier's movements. He can't have liked what he saw, for he came down in the foulest of tempers. We were dining in our tent, but we heard him screaming curses, and soon after there was a volley of musketry which seemed to come from the direction of the Fala saddle. A few single shots sounded a moment later, and Rassam told one of the servants to find out what was afoot, but the guards on our tent wouldn't let him pass. So we waited, wondering, and then word came. Theodore had remembered that a few months before one of his storekeepers had deserted and taken refuge among the Galas. The recollection had sent him into a frenzy, and he had ordered up the storekeeper's wife and infant, who had been in prison since the desertion. They and five other of his ab-prisoners had been taken to the nearest precipice, shot by a firing squad, and their bodies thrown down the cliff. The later single shots had been the finishing off of those who were still alive after the fall. "Including the child?" says Cameron. And Samuel, who had brought the news, said yes, including the child. He begged that we should not remonstrate with Theodore, who had embarked on another drinking spree and was still undetermined what to do about Napier, whose troops were believed to be preparing to cross the Bekele River next morning. When Samuel had gone, there was a long silence, broken by Prideaux. "Napier will be here the day after tomorrow." More silence, and then Rassam says, "We must do nothing to excite the king's passions. In the morning, I think I shall ask him to communicate with Sir Robert." Nobody said aye or no to that. Nobody wanted to utter a word that might influence Rassam, who might in turn influence Theodore, perhaps with terrible consequences. It all hung in the balance. Napier's progress, Theodore's madness, sheer blind chance. Blanc muttered something in Latin, and I asked what it was.
"A quotation I recollected from somewhere," says he. "At the mercy of Tiberius."
I'm not good on dates as a rule, but I know the next day was April the 9th because Rassam said it aloud as he made an entry in his journal, and it stays fixed in my memory as the day on which I was forced to witness one of the foulest crimes I've ever seen. As you know, I'm no stranger to human wickedness and cruelty and death. Slaughter in battle aside, I've watched mass scalpings and blowing from guns and the knouting of a Russian peasant. And I've seen the torture pits of Madagascar and what was left of the occupants of a New Mexican hacienda after the Mimbreno Apaches had come to call. But what happened on the eve of Good Friday at Islamgi was an atrocity apart. I can't tell why, unless it's because 'twas so unexpected and unreal and without sense or reason, committed not by a primitive savage, but by a man who only moments before had been earnestly considering Christian ethics and the problems of church and state. Blind passion I can understand, and cruelty for its own sake, but I guess madness is a law unto itself. And yet none of these, not anger or sadistic bloodlust or lunacy even, has ever seemed to me sufficient explanation for what happened on that day at Islamgi. Yet it began tamely enough, after a peaceful night in which the five of us slept undisturbed in our fine silk tent, with the other European prisoners and the German workmen in lesser tents close by. No one spoke of last night's murders, and we were at breakfast when a messenger arrived bearing compliments to Rassam from the king, which delighted him, and an order for me to present myself to the royal presence instanta, which didn't. I wasn't specially happy myself to be singled out, but there was nothing for it. So off I went. There was great action afoot in the camp, and on the north end of Islamgi, where the ground rose to the Fala saddle. A mighty crowd of prisoners had been herded together by the troops. There must have been several hundred, chained and foully dirty, squatting in the dust, and recalling the mob of them I'd seen yesterday, I found myself wondering how Magdala had contained them all, for that's where they'd come from. It struck me Theodore must have had half the local population in close tack. Rebels, criminals, folk whose faces didn't fit. But now it seemed there was to be a great jail clearance, for the armourers were passing among them, with hammers and leather straps, setting them free, and great rusty piles of fetters were in evidence, while their late wearers wandered about looking dazed and lost. Still, I took it as a good sign. Perhaps his mad majesty was seeing sense at last. My hopes were soon shot. He might be wearing his humane socks, but he was pulling on his jackboots over them. Beyond the assembled prisoners, the slopes up to the Farrashal